So today I'm going to start doing real stuff about the ADS-CFT duality. So basically we're going to talk about some fields in the bulk and some operators on the boundary and try and figure out how they're related. So I'm going to start with some sort of a motivation and try and tell a little story as to how we have some faults in the bulk and what's going to happen to them so that they might be related to some operators in a CFT or something. Then we're going to talk about massless fields. And then we're going to learn that our field is going to be dual to some operator with dimension D, then we can move to the massives case and do exactly the same thing. And then we'll find an operator that has dimension something more complicated. And then I'm going to talk about some other small topics that is related to all of the derivation I'm going to do. So, let's see. All right. Nope. So, we're going to go back a few months, and we're going to go back to our three-brain geometry, and we have our good old metric. Which looks like this. So we have our throat in the middle and then he does something. And so we separate our metrics into two big regions. Something that R is less than some scale L. And the region where R is far away from, yeah. Chalk, sure. So we split this into two regions, the part near the throat and the part away from the throat. And so we're going to be here. And the idea is that our field is going to have some sort of excitation or something happens far away at not quite infinity, but stuff happens. It moves towards us. And then from our point of view, we're going to think, oh, something is happening on a boundary. Our boundary has some sort of an excitation on it. And we're going to call this some source field, phi 0. And then that source is going to generate some scalar field in the bulk called phi. And then we would imagine that, OK, maybe phi could be related to something living on this so-called boundary that we kind of made up around here. Now, if we move to the ADS-5 part of this spacetime, and we go to the Poincaré patch, then we can imagine, OK, we put in this weird line over here. So imagine there's some sort of a cutoff of some sort at some value, some small z equals to L that more or less represents this line. And then we realize that our metric is invariant under rescaling of my coordinates. So if I said z goes to lambda times z and x mu goes to lambda x mu, my metric doesn't change. And so I can change the location of this cutoff thing from some scale z or whatever to z equals something I'm going to call a cutoff. And what you want to keep in mind is that, well, when I do this sort of rescaling, I'm doing a conformal transformation on my boundary. That's going to change my energy scales. And so the idea to keep in mind is that this cutoff, which we'll call epsilon today, is basically some UV cutoff on your field theory. Yeah.
Are they the same?
Let's put a twiddle.
And there's no curvature scale for your ADF space. What happened there?
I set it to 1.
Okay.
I'm on the motivations part, I'm big on setting everything to 1.
Okay. So can you say again? So you had originally imagined L tilde is just some arbitrary number. And then what happened? It came epsilon.
Yeah, so I'm just rescaling my coordinates by some constant. I can move this L around. I said Z goes to 2L, and my cutoff moves to 2L tilde. And then I just push that until whatever I decide to call Z cutoff. It means something on the CFT, but for us right now, we don't care too much. Let's see. So the idea that we're going to play with is we're going to have some scalar field phi in bulk, and he's going to be related to some field phi naught living on this boundary that equals epsilon. And we'd like to think that this phi naught is going to source some operator on our field theory. And our action is going to have a term that looks like phi naught times some operator O. And the story would then be that this operator O is going to be related to this field phi in the bulk. So we have some string or supergravity or something partition function in the bulk, which is a function of phi. And then we say, well, phi is going to be completely determined by its boundary conditions. And so I can call this a function of my boundary fields. And then I'll say, OK, well, this looks kind of like some, or two leading order in n squared and alpha is going to be some supergravity action, or gravity action. And then the ADS-CFT ansatz is going to tell us that this action is going to generate correlation function on the boundary. All right, so basically, I take derivatives of this respect to phi 0. I get a bunch of correlators of O. If I do the same thing on this side over here, I should be able to calculate these correlators. So that's essentially what we're going to be doing. Good. Which part?
Well, there's a Z. It's
over here?
Yeah. What's that? What goes into that tilde?
So here there's a bunch of quantum corrections, or string corrections. So there's, I don't remember what factor. So there's probably an n square that goes over here. And there's probably a whole bunch of stuff of lower order and 1 over n squared and or alpha primes.
What you meant is there was a full path integral there over all of the fields, and then you're taking a saddle point approximation.
Yeah.
Path integral. So I didn't hear that word.
That's a good word.
But you also then in the next line you made a quick transition. I didn't hear you say that the partition function of the string theory in the bulk is equal to the partition function of the conformal field theory, but it's implicit sort of there.
Yeah, well, what I've seen people say, I've never seen people say exactly those words.
Okay.
Is that you have some generating function w in my CFT, the thing with which I take all these derivatives. And that this is what I'm going to set equal to my string action at the boundary.
Right. But okay, I'm picking on you, but I will anyway.
That's okay.
Usually what you say is there's a partition function in the ADS space, which is a path integral over everything, you know, string field, graviton, and that's, we're going to set that equal to a partition function in the conformal field theory where I'm integrating over some set of degrees of freedom there. If it's n equals 4 super Yang mills, I'm doing a path integral in, you know, over gauge fields, fermions, and scalars. When I do field theory, I'm used to the idea that I introduce sources or operators, the way. And so that partition function is a function of those sources, phi naught. But if you're interested in connected components, you do this thing of you take the logarithm of the partition function. And that's what W is.
Yeah.
On the supergravity side, you took this saddle point approximation to reduce it down to the gravity action evaluated on shell. But then if I take the logarithm of that partition function, all that's left over is the supergravity action. And so we get to equate those two quantities the way you showed.
Right.
Okay.
Okay. But it's going. This step,
so, yeah, the only thing is that it starts with the assumption or the bold conjecture that Z, or the partition function of the string theory in ADF, is equal to the partition function of the conformal field theory. So I'm just dressing up what you're saying.
Yeah.
With a few more.
I'm mostly reading old papers, but there also it's also very, you know, here's a bold conjecture that we're not going to dress up too much yet.
Okay.
I don't know if since then people now are more confident that this makes sense, I guess.
No, it's still a bold conjecture.
Would those two partition functions be equal for on-shell fields after you've solved the equation? Was it just in general, because you're saying they're equal, but you've got different quantities in the two partition functions?
No, well, the partition function means path integral over all of the fields or relevant degrees of freedom. So there's no, at that stage, there's no set the fields on shell. The set the fields on shell is only the approximation. We're making an approximation to evaluate the string theory or the ADS partition function in this saddle point approximation. And that says you pick out a special critical point or you're in the saddle or in the path integral. And so you're evaluating it on shell. But on the other side, there's that phi naught is not something that you're sticking on shell. What it is simply that the partition function, or you've modified the conformal field theory path integral to stick these extra sources with that are sourcing. You're producing, as Alex said, a generating functional for the correlation functions of those operators. So you stick that exponential into the path integral. And phi naught, I think of, often you use the words, those are the currents or the sources for the operator.
Any more questions? All right, so two quick examples that you can see.
Is phi naught is a current that is
made up of content in n is equal to 4. What's going to do it? It's something new you are adding in the system.
So
n
equals 4 supernumeral is better than me. Normally, I mean, I remember my confusion. You basically can always just keep adding currents to your action with whatever it is you want to calculate, and then vary with respect to those currents, kind of that correlation function, and set the currents to 0.
Yeah.
So I imagine in words, sparing mills, that
so finite is not, it's a current, it's an external source. It's not a quantum field that you're integrating over. It's something external that you're probing the path integral with. But that O is actually something composed out of n equals 4 super Yang Mills field. I mean, did you see operators like trace of phi to the n? What I was aware of? Okay. No, that's fine.
All right, so the idea is we have some phi in the bulk, and we're going to have something that looks like phi naught. Phi naught O on the boundary. And so we can give some quick examples of this. So if I have a CFT, it's local, one of the operators is going to be some T mu nu, and it's going to have some HP nu like this. So this guy is going to be my phi 0. This is my operator. And so in the bulk, this h mu nu is just the boundary value of my metric g mu nu. So then I say, oh, well, my metric is going to be dual to a stress energy tensor. I can have a term that's going to look like the Lagrangian, and it's going to have a string coupling in front of it. Well, the string coupling is just the boundary value of some dilaton field. And so we're going to say, OK, well, so the dilaton field is going to be dual to adding a Lagrangian to the CFT. So that's kind of the picture we want to have. So that's all just a little motivation. But let's actually do something for real. So what we want to do is look at a massless scalar field in ADS with some boundary condition, some phi naught on the boundary. And we're going to solve the field equations for this massless scalar field in the bulk. To do this, we're going to have to calculate a Green's function for the field. So when we calculate the Green's function, that's going to give us a propagator between the bulk and the boundary, which I will probably use later. And then if we stick this phi back into our action I of phi here, and we take derivatives with respect to phi 0, then we can calculate a whole bunch of correlation functions and be happy. So are there any questions right now before I start that? All right, so we work in the Poincaré patch. And our action is just d mu phi, d mu phi. So what we want to do is we want to find a Green's function for the scalar field, right? So I want to find some function, I'm going to call it k, which is equal to some delta function. I think this is x right now.
Is that a delta function in
just the x? Just the x's. I'm in the bulk, so it shouldn't be. But later it kind of looks. At some point, I'll take a boundary limit, but I want my solution to work everywhere. Let's demand that it's equal to that
on the boundary, it's going to be a delta function. All right, so I stick, well, at least I stick this with my metric over here. And we get our field equations for this Green's function. So derivative of z1 minus d. Let's skip the quick step here. All right, so we want to solve this equation. That's a complicated equation, so we have to be clever. And so the way we're clever about here is that we say, OK, we're going to pick the point at infinity. And we're going to solve the function there. And then because ADS has a whole lot of isometries, we can actually map the point at infinity back into our spacetime and get some general Green's function that works everywhere. So the reason we want to work at infinity is that our boundary conditions are symmetric. And so our k. So at this point, our k is only going to depend on z. So if I plug this into my equations, I just get a function as a function of k of z. So I get just d dz of z1 minus d dzk equals 0. And then if I demand that k looks like some power function z to something, I find that my k at the point infinity looks like some constant times z to the d. It's the point. The center of ADS. Like if I'm in.
That doesn't make sense.
So if z goes to infinity.
As far as I know, you have the many options here. But
you can just write out the equation, right? It's always, you don't have to look at the infinity.
Well, he wants to do it in a clever way, which is fine.
I've never seen this done in a clever way.
Huh?
No, I mean, unless you go, because I don't want to go to momentum space, and if you just want to write down the differential equation and solve it, as far as I know, you have to be clever. And so Witten says that he said this at z equals infinity, and McGreevy says that he said it that all the other xi's are infinity, yeah. Not z.
Well, do you remember what the picture looks like of the Penrose diagram for the Poincaré, well, for ADS and the Poincaré patch?
Yeah, so I don't know if they mean, well, I mean, I imagine we might mean this point, but I'm not.
Oh, I was guessing the other point.
Let's get here.
Yeah.
That probably works more with z equals infinity. Okay, so let's. That makes some sense.
No, he's going to do something else. Yeah, okay.
All right, so we have this. K z is something times z to the d,
and that's only valid at our point at infinity, and that's not quite good. So we do a transformation x mu goes to x mu over z squared plus xi xi. And that is a nice isometry of ADS, so that's all good. And when we do this, you find that your k of z is mapped to some function of both z and x. And now it's going to be c times z to the d over z squared plus xi xi to the d. And so we're going to call this, so do a translation of our x's and call this x minus x prime. And all of this thing is what we're going to call our bulk to boundary propagator.
I'm not sure if that zero is erased or not. Your p z of that thing is zero.
Oh, yeah, that is. It's not erased. It's just very pale. But yeah, there's a zero between the right bracket and the k.
I thought it was equal to a delta.
Well, it is, but the delta function is, as long as we're not at that particular point where the delta exists. And so our delta is going to be on the boundary anyway. So as long as we're in the bulk, we're far away from the peak of our delta function. So we just call it zero.
So is the point P in the bulk?
Yeah.
Oh.
If the point P is in the bulk, is it cannot be infinity in the bulk or coordinates? So it is zero.
What?
I mean it.
Oh, if it weren't in the bulk, it would be zero.
I mean that you say that p infinity, infinity means in z infinity?
Yeah.
But on boundary, z is zero.
That's why I said it's in the bulk.
In the bulk?
Yeah, we're not on the boundary.
Yeah,
it says
arbitrary.
So you're setting x prime equal to that point, right? To the point p. You have that point P equals infinity, and you're solving for K away from the boundary.
Yeah. Okay.
Actually, I think that shows me your notation is such that X mu actually runs over Z and a bunch of XIs. Is that true?
Yes.
Okay. So I think that delta function was a five-dimensional delta function, probably. Over
I think so, too. So I think one way to say it is that's going to be a five-dimensional delta function. But I'm always going to pick one of the x and x prime to live on the boundary. So we don't really care.
I think that it's most clear if you say that you first solve the equation in the bulk just with five-dimensional delta function, you find some green function that like always depends on two points. And then you take the limit of one of those two points going to the boundary. And that gives you the bulk boundary propagator. I think it's the most clear thing. I don't know why you want to avoid going momentum space or whatever, but otherwise it seems kind of convoluted.
It's actually, I mean, that's one. The only reason I like that approach is because if you're doing the graviton propagator, that's the only way I know how to do it. Perhaps for pedagogical purposes, if we're doing scalars, the other approach might have been easier. But
I like that approach because we'd probably have to do it later anyways.
Okay.
So. Okay, so we have our propagator. And
so I have a question.
Yeah.
Do you have to pick some boundary conditions for this?
We haven't yet,
okay.
But we will.
Because it seems like
right now we just solve some field equations. We haven't even mentioned boundary conditions. But we haven't found our field yet either.
Right. I guess I'm just thinking that usually when you find a Green's function, you either choose an advanced or retarded or something. You have to put in some extra input that gives the boundary value.
So we still have an integration constant, right?
This, you mean this C?
Yeah. So we've used one boundary condition somewhere.
I think you actually are doing this in Euclidean space. I think your XIs are all Euclidean. So there's not a boundary condition in that sense. Implicitly, you did choose a boundary condition, though, because when you solve a second order of,
I hit that one into the rug. But I want my propagator to be 0 and it equals 0. So I just
right.
Kept the constant.
So those x, so the i's are just like I equals 1 to 3. You don't have
I
time direction there?
Sorry?
Well, is one of those x's time?
No.
No.
Okay. Good.
But it's 1, 2, 3,
right.
4. There is a fourth coordinate, but they're all you. For the purposes, I think, of today's lecture, or at least this part of the lecture, I think they're just Euclidean coordinates.
I see. So we've wick rotated or something.
Yeah.
Okay.
So talking about the Poincaré patch wasn't quite right, but going to infinity actually doesn't matter how you go there. It'll push you to a special point on the boundary in this coordinate system.
Yeah. That's why initially I just said the point at infinity. But then
yeah, I know.
I got confused. Any more questions?
How do you know that K is a polynomial?
Well, you can write it as a power series. You can plug the power series in your differential equation in real time. This is the answer.
What does mu mean at I?
This mu?
Yeah.
Does it contain one?
Is there an extra?
This one runs for one more coordinate than this one.
But they're the same.
Yeah, except, so this one could be Z, this one couldn't. All right, so there's two things about this guy. So first of all, if I write this quantity, so if I were to integrate K of Z over the boundary, or at least over d-dimensional x's, I find that this is independent of z. And you can see this just by scaling z goes to lambda times z, and you'll find this won't depend on lambda. And then the second convenient fact is that as z goes to 0, k is going to 0 except at x equals x prime. And so we think it's probably, or it might be a delta function, which I won't do, but I think someone does it later. Because this stuff comes up many, many times. So basically you find, because we need rk to satisfy,
proof. I mean, it's zero
yeah,
everywhere.
Yeah, this is proof. Well, you might be
somewhere else, and the only thing you have to say is that integral was finite.
It's finite. Yeah, I just don't want to integrate it.
Okay.
But you can believe me that if I integrate it, it's probably going to be finite, and that's good enough for my purposes. So we have our propagator.
So we have our propagator, so we can use it to find some wave function, some function phi at the next size. So we're just going to integrate. So we have my Green's function in the middle. And then I want to integrate some other function, which I'll call phi 0, such that at the boundary, this thing actually goes to phi naught, which in this case works. So doesn't look like it did much here. I just threw in my wave function. When we do this for the massless case, there's going to be a little subtlety here.
So x prime is in the bulk and x is on the boundary.
Yeah.
What did you ask
him? I was asking if x prime is in the bulk and you're trying to take it from the bulk to the
boundary. I'm only integrating on the boundary. All right, fixed that at least. But yeah, on the boundary because that's where phi naught exists.
Phi naught is only a function of x prime. But it's you can think of that as being the values on the boundary. I mean, that's what the next line is. But then he's using the Green's function to determine phi, given that source on the boundary or boundary condition. He's evaluating it with the Green's function to determine what phi is at an arbitrary point.
So the opposite of what I said.
I think so, yeah.
So like the picture is I have ADS and I have some field phi naught on the boundary at x. And then I'm going to have a propagator k, which is going to bring me to some phi at x.
So then
I integrate.
So that dx measure is over all the coordinates, maybe not vector hat?
No.
So see, if I'm in ADS d plus 1, this is just d.
Okay.
The phi naught really just lives on the slice at infinity.
Okay.
So there's no, it doesn't, phi naught doesn't depend on z. We've sort of implicitly stuck it at z equals 0.
So this cz to the d, you can pull it out of the
Yeah.
So all our fields are going to have that behavior. Okay.
Although there's more z dependent.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of z's here from the root g.
Sorry?
From the determinant of the metric, there's a bunch of z's over here. And in this case, they cancel out. Because we have 1 over z to the d, which is why at the boundary, this guy vanishes, these guys cancel out, and we're stuck with just phi naught times the delta function.
Okay.
Okay, so we have our field that solves our equation of motion. And then the idea is I want to stick that.
Are you going to tell us what C is?
I'm not, no.
Okay.
It has an exciting normalization in terms of gammas, but I didn't find it that interesting.
Okay.
So you can set the constant, or at least one way to set this constant C is you can demand that I set that. If you integrate k, you expect to find, your k looks like a delta function, d of k. And so if you normalize your delta function to 1, that's going to set the value of c, and it's going to be a whole bunch of gamma functions. So we have our phi, we have our action, so I can plug my field inside my action I of phi over here.
And then whatever we get, hopefully, is going to look like some sort of a generating functional for correlation functions or something I might be able to use to calculate stuff. All right, so we have our action, which was this integral root g dv phi squared. And so you integrate this by parts, and I can rewrite this as d mu of phi d mu phi on minus the integral of phi box phi. Now this is just my equations of motion, and so this guy is zero, and this guy is just going to be a surface integral on my boundary. So I just get this integral over the boundary of phi times derivative of phi. And then we just want to plug in our field. Okay, so I know my phi is a function of z. I can calculate the derivative of phi with respect to z. And I want to do this as z goes to 0, because I only need it on the boundary. And so this is going to be c dz d minus 1, so just take the derivative. And then the rest is going to be the same thing as my phi, only with z equal to 0 at the bottom. So phi naught of x prime dx prime.
Is there a factor of half in your action that should be there? It's there, yeah, in the box.
There's probably a factor of half everywhere.
You're just,
you can hide it inside the c if you want. It's another convenient reason to keep these guys around.
Can you explain again what happened there?
Yeah. Right, so I have this big function of phi, and I want to take the derivative with respect to z.
Yep.
And I want to do this near the boundary, because that's where I'm going to be integrating this function. I'm trying to plug that in here. So if I, so at the bottom over here, to leading order in z, this term doesn't exist. And so if I differentiate like z, all I have is this z d at the top, which becomes dz d minus 1, which we have here, times my constant. And then the rest of the integral doesn't depend on z, so it just comes directly here. And then we're going to have, should be, and then next order is going to have two extra powers of z, because we have this z squared at the bottom.
Sorry, that's order z to the d plus 1?
Yeah, that's a plus. Okay, so I have, so we have our field, we have the derivative of the field. So I can just plug that into my action, and I find that my I of phi has some factor in front. And then two phi naughts. And some x minus x prime to the 2d at the bottom.
So where does the z go?
The z went into the measure. Let's see how that happened. So we have, there's a zd minus 1 over here. There's a 1 over z to the d in root h. And my normal vector has a z flying around in it at the top. So all these z's cancel out. That looks right.
But your normal vector is just like one in the direction. So.
It's one normalized. I want
MU normalized in ADS. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Equals zero.
Equals one. But yeah, that'll give. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So have one over square root of one of the measurements.
Okay. So both phi and derivative of phi involve integrals, and then there's an integral you're sticking them into an integral, and yet you only wrote down two integrals there. No, what I'm asking is, that first integral is an integral over x.
Yeah, we're saying.
And then each of the phi of x's, or the derivative of phi of x, have an integral over another coordinate x.
All right, there's three integrals.
Yeah, there's three coordinates
three
in play, and
in addition,
we have two down. And I imagine there must be a delta function. Because essentially everything here are delta functions. I'm not quite seeing where. Do you happen to know where it is?
That one I can't help you with, but you could probably just do the integral, right? It's powered.
Which
integral? Actually, that power is wrong. That's 2 to the d, but that's beside the point.
Yeah.
I think you just did the x integral, the outside integral. That one with the square root. Yeah. Or no, the one down. Implicitly, that was an integral over x.
Yeah. So
and
I have an x prime, x prime.
Right. But that integral looks pretty simple in that it's. I mean, it's just an integral over dx, and then there's x minus x prime to a power, x minus x double prime to a power. But I think you went a little bit quick, but I'll believe you that that's the answer.
The answer. I imagine in the middle step there's a delta function. When we do the third integral, the 1 over x minus x prime. So,
I think Anton has a question for you.
Yes.
So where did the square root of g go?
Implicit in half time, so where exactly? Here?
Yeah. If those were all covariant derivatives, it might work.
Yeah,
just keep everything covariant. I mean, this action here, I can rewrite like that and move things around. I'm just writing it as partial if it's acting on a scalar.
Well,
If they're not covariant derivatives, I think you can just put the square root of g inside the first gradient. Okay. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Okay, so the next thing to notice about this here is that if I take two derivatives with respect to these phi naughts, then I'm going to get something that looks like a correlation function for a CFT operator. And so that looks like the correlation function of OO, where O has dimension D. So, you know, that says the correspondence seems to make some sort of sense. So that's good. So let's quickly do the same thing for the massive case. Right, so we just update everything. So now my action is going to be d mu phi squared plus n squared phi squared. I put that into my
equations of motion. So we play the same trick. We choose our point at infinity. Here, property generally depends on z. Use our equations of motion.
First, second order differential equation for the property of when you've just written down here. And I think that one's wrong. Like,
sorry, what did you
mean? The one partial z, z1 minus d partial z k equals 0, is not the same as what you've written over there in the m equals 0 case. Because I think you forgot.
Well, then, I mean, if it's equal to 0, I just divide by.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. Thank you, Alex.
But he's right. You were being sloppy up there and throwing away. So that's not. D'Alembertian, that's D'Alembertian with some stuff thrown away.
Oh, right, did I write that?
Oh, yeah.
Exactly.
Sorry, I just, but you're right.
That's the equation
you have to solve.
I meant for the whole answer equal.
Yeah, well, it is equal. It's just you skipped some steps and I got confused.
So let's go slowly enough that Ross doesn't get confused.
Thank you.
Our goal.
Yeah.
Right, so we do the same thing as before. Now we're going to call gamma. I don't remember what I used before. So my k is going to be some polynomial. I plug this into this equation, and I'm going to find that m squared must be equal to gamma times gamma minus d. And this has two roots, gamma plus or minus. And so for now, we're only going to choose gamma plus, and we're going to talk about gamma minus in a few minutes when I'm done with this derivation. Yeah, I'll tell the whole gamma plus minus story. I'll tell the majority of the gamma plus minus story. So we have our propagator
looks like z to the gamma. And so we do our same transformation x mu like above over here. And that equation is still good. So my propagator now is going to be the same one as here, except that everywhere you see a d, you replace it by a gamma. And indeed, when you set m to be 0, then this gamma was equal to d, so everything works out. Any questions so far? This massive case is going a lot better. Yeah?
Bottom board every time.
OK. That's probably a good idea. So I've got my propagator. I plug that into an integral to find my wave function phi. So our function at zn x is going to be constant x prime . So we do the same thing as before, but there's one very important difference with regards to the boundary condition that we didn't have and that we have here, is that if I take the limit z goes to 0 for this expression, then I find it actually looks like z to the gamma minus d times phi naught. And so this gamma plus. And it turns out that from this equation, you can see gamma plus gamma minus is equal to d. And so this looks like 1 over z to the gamma minus times phi 0. I'm not sure about that power. So anyways, it looks like phi naught times z to some power is equal to.
Actually, what did you write there?
This is 1 over gamma minus, 1 over z to the gamma minus.
Gamma minus?
I'm wondering about this 1 over. That doesn't seem to make any sense.
What?
Gamma minus
what?
What's gamma minus?
Gamma minus
you
is.
You mean it's just z to the minus gamma minus?
Yeah.
Which is why your equation says.
Yeah, that's.
Sorry?
Your equation says that x plus or gamma plus minus d equal to minus.
Oh. Well, yeah, no. Well, that's what it says, but that's my. I don't trust the result. This looks suspicious to me.
Why?
It's correct.
Because it. Is it?
You can just plug it in, right? Like.
Why no, but I.
Oh.
I have a vague recollection that my field has to vanish and not to infinity at the boundary.
Oh.
But maybe, yeah.
Is gamma minus positive or negative?
Sorry? It's, depends. Depends on that.
Oh, yeah, right. Then we're in ADS, so no square can be negative.
So anyway, there's some power here, and McGreevy probably has it right. So if it depends, then McGreevy's power is probably better than my power. Right, so anyway, so the idea was that initially I said my boundary condition is that phi at the boundary must be equal to phi 0. But it turns out if your mass is non-zero, then you don't have a nice scalar field equation where the boundary is nice and finite like this. And so we define our boundary conditions to have this either 0 or infinity in front of our boundary conditions. So that's unfortunate. So anyway, so I have my wave function. I can plug that into my action, like I may have erased that. But I can use this and find my actions before. So now it's going to look again like phi naught of x, phi naught at x prime, over x minus x prime to the 2 gamma. And again, if I take 2 there, there with respect to phi naught, it'll look like a correlation function or a two-point function for some operator O that has dimension delta equals gamma, which was gamma plus. Are there any questions about this?
When you took the limit z goes to zero, what exactly were you doing there? Where did the power of z come from?
Well, there's a 1 over d inside my measure. So this is z to the minus d. This is z to the gamma. This z disappears.
So you're saying there's a square root of h hidden in that?
Yeah. There's a square root of h in most of the integrals. So add square root of h everywhere so that everything's Lorentz invariant. Okay, so let's talk about gamma plus. So we have this my equation m squared is gamma minus d. I've got these two solutions. When m squared is positive, then gamma minus is going to be negative. And then if I kept going, I'd find negative conformal dimension for my operator O. And that doesn't sound like a good thing. So that's the main reason why people generally play with gamma plus. But the real right, so since we have two roots, then we can imagine that our field looks like, say, z to the d minus gamma times phi, 0 plus z to the gamma times some other function, a of x.
Sorry, try again.
I'm confused myself too. Let's use gamma plus and gamma minus. This one is minus plus. So I can expand my solution in z with respect to the two roots of this guy, and then you say, okay, well, one of them is going to dominate, and I'm going to pick this solution. So normally you pick this. By zero.
So if I can say it slightly differently, if I was looking at a general solution to that equation, I can do a power series expansion, and there would be two, because it's a second order equation, there would be two independent solutions.
Yeah.
And so if I built the full power series expansion, One of those independent solutions would start with that term.
That's a good way.
I think it's supposed to be z to the gamma plus.
Yeah, that's
like fine.
My chalk has a.
I think
it's jumping
gamma,
that
plus.
Is a gamma plus.
No, times the finite. Isn't that what?
No, it's like this. And that's why I didn't like that power earlier. We got the opposite of that, or something different.
So, okay, which one are you saying dominates asymptotically?
Gamma naught is negative, right?
Right.
So we are going to have 1 over 0.
Say that again?
Gamma
minus
negative.
Is negative.
So this is going to, z is going to be small.
Yeah, okay.
So I get 0 to a negative power, and that dominates over 0 to a positive power.
I'm sorry, I'm a little behind. Why as z goes to 0 does phi look like z to the gamma sigma plus minus p on the top board.
Where? Like.
Oh, so in, so I have this vx prime, and I didn't write it, but when I write vx prime, I may include the volume form square root of the metric.
Oh, right.
So that has a 1 over z to the t in front, and then there's a z to the gamma in the numerator.
Okay.
So you get.
Actually, I don't think you have that z to t, that indication, the top, and from there you get the, all the powers correct.
Sorry?
On the top, phi zx is equal to c,
yeah,
and then integration of x. So that is only on the flat boundary. And from there, you'll start getting all the powers correct. You'll have z plus, which will be u phi naught, that will be equal later, and then other. I don't think you have z d there in the integration. It's on the boundary.
I'm pretty sure, I mean, the boundary has it. The boundary has powers of z, though. My boundary is really just an induced metric on some submanifold. I'm not doing anything. Yeah.
It looks to me like you have z to the gamma over z to the 2 gamma of that.
Well, z goes to 0, so the x minus x prime dominates with the z.
Oh.
Okay, let's keep telling the story. So if we have m squared greater than 0, then I have gamma plus is positive, and gamma minus is negative. And then I say, okay, I'm not going to choose gamma minus, it's negative, and or yeah, we'll bring a whole lot of problems. So I stay with my first solution here. If we have the mass between minus d squared over 4 and minus d squared over 4 plus 1, then both roots are okay. And so the idea is, if my mass squared is within this region, then I'm actually dual to two different CFTs. One of them has an operator O with dimension delta plus, and the other one has operator O with dimension delta minus. And that's finished right here. So this sounds kind of weird. They have your one action, your one bulk, and your dual to these two things. But it turns out that's a good thing. So we have our gamma plus, and it's bounded from below at d over 2. But if you do the CFT, there's no bound at d over 2 on the conformal dimension of your operators. And so you might think, well, why, how do I have some weird bound on one side, but there's no bound on the CFT, therefore this duality can't really make sense. But what you find is that actually gamma minus in that mass range. It is bounded from below at d over 2 minus 1. And it turns out that this is actually the unitary bound. For operators in CFT. And so now it makes sense. We recovered this old bound that we had. In this case, it just comes from a bound on the mass square term. Does that make any sense? Anyone have any questions?
That makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense.
Yeah, great.
So we can give another argument for why the operator O would have dimension. Gamma. So if I look at my action on the boundary, so I have this integral at z equals epsilon, and then I'm going to have some finite times my operator. So if I go close to the boundary, my root h looks like 1 over z to the d, my phi 0 looks like z to the d minus gamma, and then I have an O. And so if I want my action to stay finite, then I need my O to have conformal dimension gamma here. Right, so I need O to look like z to the delta times some renormalized operator O. Let's see, some other stuff. So we have this relation delta, delta minus d is equal to m squared. So we did that for a scalar field. So if you have a J form in your bulk, then this actually generalizes to delta plus J minus d equals m squared. So if you have some vector a mu and it's got some current j mu, then that's a one form, and so my j equals one, and I have delta to be d minus one. Then I can look at, say, g mu nu is going to have some stress energy tensor t mu nu, and this is going to have delta equals d minus 2, which I think is for the safety side. So hopefully everything is OK. And so this is the more general expression that we get as we have done everything.
So when you say form, you don't mean an anti-symmetric tensor necessarily, if you're applying it to T mu nu and G mu nu. You just mean a rank J tensor.
Yeah,
usually,
rank J current.
Usually form means anti-symmetric, but in this case not.
Yeah, well, people use form in a whole lot of ways.
Okay.
Well, like a metric is a bilinear form.
Okay.
Unless Rob, you have something very clever to say.
No, a form is a form. I think he's right. T mu nu is not a form. T mu is a form.
Differential form, I think.
Is
what you people usually mean by form.
That's what I was. So I couldn't find the actual answer to what happens here if I have an arbitrary tensor in the bulk.
Yeah.
I'm not sure, like if I have a fermion, I'm not sure if this J actually gets 1/2. And I could find that.
But it's also true that that's the wrong answer for the stress tensor.
Is it D?
It's D.
Okay.
So maybe you could fix that.
The entire plan being wrong.
No, it was, well, everything was right. It's just delta is D. So that shows that your formula
that means this is your form.
He didn't mean form, yeah.
No, it just means T mu nu is not a form, and so your formula for forms does not apply.
Fair enough.
Can we erase minus 2?
Yes.
Okay.
Do you know what happens for fermions? Because I couldn't find that anywhere. Like, are they just not a form, and so it is there, or?
Fermions are not forms either.
So anything that's not a form is not a form.
Yeah, so you should do the analysis over again.
All right, so that's something else. Quick word on tachyons, because we're running a bunch of negative masses everywhere. So in ABS, we have this neat bound that m squared squared equal to minus d squared over 4. So in this case, if I have free scalar field in bulk, I'm going to have one boundary condition if I try and solve the system. If my mass squared is in that range that I had before, so as d squared over 4.
Can you just slow down a little? What do you mean one boundary condition?
One admissible boundary condition with positive energy. And I think that's all I'm assuming.
But you're saying you make the choice that you made there, that gamma plus is going to be the dimension of the operator?
Well, I mean, in this case, if I just, you know, if I forget about ABS CFT.
Oh, okay.
And so if I go back in
1982,
and I study some fields propagating in ABS, I've got some equations of motion, and I say, okay, well, what's the range of masses for which I have boundary conditions that work? If my mass is in this range, I have one admissible boundary condition. If my mass is in this range, I have two boundary conditions, and that's ultimately the reason why you have this gamma plus, gamma minus. And otherwise, I have zero admissible boundary conditions. So I have negative entropy energy.
So I got out of you so far that what we're doing now is we're just studying the wave equation.
Yeah, you're studying the wave equation.
So what do you mean one boundary condition?
I have a set of fields in the bulk and boundary conditions on the boundary.
So I'm going
so
to
that the field equations
equals
are
zero, or I mean, are they Neumann boundary conditions, Dirichlet? I'm just not sure what you mean when you say boundary
conditions. I think I mean anything.
Anything. I'm not sure how, if I can have anything, there's only one of them.
I looked at the paper this morning.
Not really sure what he's telling us, no.
Well, for one thing, it should be Dirichlet odds, right? You cannot talk about Neumann at this point because we're just fixing some boundary value. So,
I imagine we're just fixing boundary values of the field. And I think what we're saying is that given the field configuration in the bulk, there's two different boundary conditions which give rise to the same field. Just like we have. So I think that's...
I want to guess that maybe what you mean is that there are two different boundary conditions for which you have still
the same
stable configurations. They may be different, but...
Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
so that's
like
getting closer to an answer I wanted.
Like classes of boundaries.
No, but I think what you're saying is we've already studied the wave equation. There are two independent solutions, and they're on the board right behind you. And so one way to approach the problem is to say that I'm going to specify the problem. I mean, it's an elliptic problem. I'm going to specify it by specifying phi naught. Another way would be to say that I'm going to specify the problem by specifying A. And so you're saying in one range, I get to make one choice. And that's, I should choose phi naught. That'll lead to a well-posed problem.
Yeah.
Whereas in this other range, you have your pick. You can say that phi naught's the thing that I'm going to fix. And then A is sort of determined by your wave equation, where Or alternatively, the second choice is that you fix A.
So when you say one boundary condition versus two boundary conditions, we're saying you have one possible choice versus two possible choices?
I'm saying my field can look something like that.
Yeah.
And so if I say I'm going to fix my boundary condition just by specifying A, type this, then that would be one boundary condition.
And so the zero boundary conditions probably means that any choice just has some decaying decaying mode or something.
Yeah, basically for mass squared less than this, it's the same issue as this normal type. You have average energy. All right, so one last thing.
There's a manual button.
Okay, so a quick word about relevantness. So if our mass squared is larger than zero, then my dimension is going to have gamma. It's going to have to be gamma plus is larger than d. So we're going to have an irrelevant deformation. Right, so if I have my action is going to look like a mass, so a 1 over z to the d minus delta times this operator. And so that term will go to 0 in the IR range. Then when gamma equals d, that's n squared, that is 0. Yeah. So equal d and marginal. And then when n squared is less than 0, but still larger than that bound that we had, then we're going to have a relevant deformation. And I'm going to stop here. Are there any questions?
Yeah, 1 second.
We're waiting for us.
Thanks. Nobody else has a question. This delta minus e, m squared, you're just like counting powers somewhere? Or can you justify that a little bit?
How I find this?
Yeah, like what statements came along with that equation?
So we did this a while ago. So I have a differential equation. I say my, I probably have it in somewhere. It's, you know, say z to the delta.
Oh, it's just my m squared.
Oh, maybe I should get my gamma to the delta.
Oh, okay. That's fine. Yeah, that's good. Yeah. I see the two equations.
Yeah, okay.
So, okay.
Anything else?